شيل شيل عجم مالي شيل يا حوطك والله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو.
You're tuned in to This Week in Palestine, a space where truth is not shaped to comfort the powerful, where resistance is not a metaphor, but the pulse of daily survival, and where solidarity is not a fleeting gesture, but a heartbeat carried through generations. From the heart of occupation, voices rise, not alone, not as whispers swallowed by empire, but together, moving in rhythm with struggles across the world that insist on justice, dignity, and liberation for all. This is not simply a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread running from Palestine to every corner of the earth, binding shattered homes to unshaken hope, binding rubble to resolve, binding grief to a future still worth imagining. It is a reminder that even in the darkest nights, the flame of defiance refuses to fade. Each week, we bring you reporting that refuses disguise, analysis that cuts through distortion, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, struggle, beauty, and humanity. We do not soften. We do not dilute. We speak with clarity, because the stakes are far too high for anything less than truth. We map the architecture of power, the policies that suffocate, the narratives that erase, the forces that silence, and we follow their echoes across borders, from Ferguson to Jenin, from refugee camps to classrooms, from Gaza to the conscience of the world. This Week in Palestine is not a sanctuary for polite avoidance. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without apology. Because the struggle for liberation is not bound to one land, one people, or one moment in time. It is shared. It is global. And it is sacred. Before we begin, a quick reminder. The views in this hour belong to our hosts and guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. This is not a space for polite restraint. This is a space for truth spoken clearly, urgently, and without apology. Good morning. Good evening. Wherever you are listening from, thank you for being here. I'm your host, Bethany Marks, and you're tuned in to This Week in Palestine. Today is Sunday, February 1st, 2026. In this broadcast, we examine how political narratives are shaped, how they are used to discredit critics, and how they influence public understanding of the crisis in Palestine. Then later, we hear from a Holocaust survivor who reflects on the present moment and speaks to the moral responsibilities we all share. And through it all, our focus stays fixed on Gaza and the West Bank, lands under siege, enduring what no people should ever endure. Homes reduced to rubble, people uprooted under the weight of global indifference. Yet one truth remains. Palestinians continue to resist, even now, even as the threat of renewed violence looms. So we ask, when will the world confront the cost of its silence? When will conscience rise above convenience? Stay with us as we cut through the noise, as we lift up the resilient, as we hold space for truth that refuses to be buried.
شيل شيل عجمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو.
The misinformation we're seeing today is believed by many, but just as many are beginning to ask harder questions, searching for facts instead of slogans. When a commentator like Ben Shapiro speaks about history while blending fact with myth and distortion, it becomes essential to shine a light on those claims and examine them critically. Shapiro often delivers his arguments from behind the safety of a microphone, insulated from direct challenge, confident that no one in the moment can confront him with the historical record. But Adnan Rashid has taken it upon himself to do exactly that. In his detailed commentary responding to the video debunking every lie Shapiro told on Israel's history, he walks through Shapiro's statements one by one, offering context, evidence, and historical clarity. A deeper look at the narrative Shapiro presents is not only useful, it is necessary. Let's listen. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College.
شيل شيل عجمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو.
The things that we've been seeing on our screens from Hamas are atrocities, obviously. But the media have said that these atrocities, they're really missing context. The context they are providing, well, that context is a bunch of lies.
He's an absolute liar. There's no doubt in my mind that he's an absolute propagandist and liar. And instead of getting personal, I'm going to get to his so-called arguments.
Myth number one, Israel is historically Muslim territory. This is a pure and absolute lie. Israel is historically Jewish territory. According to the Bible and certain interpretations of contemporaneous archaeology, Joshua entered the land of Israel in 1400 BC. The Kingdom of David was founded around 1000 BC. The first Temple of Solomon was built in approximately 957 BC. The second temple was built in approximately 515 BC. The Hasmonean dynasty was founded in 166 BC. Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 BC, and the Jews exiled from Israel in 136 CE after the defeat of the Bar Kokhba revolt. The Romans, in an attempt to shame the Jews, renamed the area Palestine as an insult after the Jews' historic enemy, the Philistines. Even during the exile, there was continuous Jewish presence in the land. Islam, which is the religion of the Palestinian Arabs, was not even founded until the 7th century CE or AD. No independent Arab state has ever existed in the area known as Palestine.
He's saying that Israel or the land of Palestine has been historically Jewish territory. He himself disproves himself by presenting the evidence that Joshua came to the land of Palestine in the 15th century BC. If that's the case, who was there before Joshua came? My question is, who was in the land of Palestine before the Israelites came to the land of Palestine? These people were called the Canaanites or Philistines by some other people. So there were Palestinians or Canaanites, or call them blue flying elephants. Call them anything you like. There were people in the land of Palestine before the Israelites turned up. And then Israelites themselves were taken away from this land. Okay, we know about the Assyrian attack on the land of Palestine. We know about the Babylonian exile. The king of Babylon attacked the land of Palestine and took the entire Jewish population to Iraq. Now, if the Jewish people today were to claim ownership of the land of Iraq because they lived in the land of Iraq for nearly 2,000 years, are we going to accept that claim? If the Jewish people claim ownership of America, let's say today, based upon the fact that they have been here for the last 500 years, are we going to accept that claim? If the Jewish people claimed ownership of the land of Spain because they lived there for over 1,000 years, are we going to accept that claim? If we start accepting these claims because someone came into a land, inhabited the land for 1,000 years or 2,000 years, and by that virtue, the land becomes theirs, and people who have come to these lands later on, they have no right to the land. This is a very bogus and very, very ahistoric claim to make over a piece of land. The Jewish people have been moving around the world throughout the diaspora period. Okay, so this is a very, very ahistoric claim to make. Very weak argument for that matter. In fact, many of the Israelites, they accepted Islam. They became Muslims. What are we going to do with them? Many Palestinian people today are actually originally Israelites. They have Israelite DNA. What are we going to do with them? We're going to throw them out just because they adopted the Muslim faith. So this is more about Islam then it is about the ownership of the land. The problem is with the faith. Okay, these Zionists don't like Islam and Muslims, and this is why they make this propaganda.
Myth number two, Israel is the cause of the failure of land partition in the Middle East. This is, again, a pure lie. In 1917, the British promised the Jews the entire area of Palestine, at the time, Israel and Transjordan, which is today's Jordan. In 1920, the Arabs began pogroms, a mass murder of Jews, in Jerusalem as a sign of anger at the British mandate in Palestine. In 1922, the British government, in response, announced in a white paper that the Transjordan area, 70% of Palestine, would be sliced off and made an Arab state. That would become Jordan. In 1937, the Peel Commission recommended a rump state for the Jews, in which the British would retain control over Jaffa and Jerusalem, the Arabs would get the entire Negev and nearly the entirety of Judea and Samaria, and the Jews would get a tiny swath of territory along the coast, including Tel Aviv and Haifa. In 1939, the British, in response again to Arab pressure, restricted Jewish immigration to Palestine just as the Nazis began World War II and just before the Holocaust. Nonetheless, the Jews sided with the Brits, the Arabs sided with Hitler. In 1948, the British mandate ended and Israel declared its independence.
David Ben-Gurion read the Proclamation of Independence to 13 other members of the Israel Provisional National Council. Israel had taken its place among the nations of the world.
In 1964, with the Arabs still in full control of the Gaza Strip and West Bank, the Palestine Liberation Organization was founded, calling for the destruction of Israel. Here is a contemporaneous British report on the first chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization.
Okay, so I would like to say here that this partition was unjust in the first place. The British mandate had no right to give the land that belonged to the Palestinian people to an extremist entity called the Zionist movement. The Zionists were made of European Jews, Eastern European Jews, who had come up with this theory that they own the land of Zion, in other words, Palestine, and they need to take it by hook or by crook. Okay, this was an atheistic movement driven by some religious ideas, ironically, right? So they came and they took the land of Palestine by force from the people who were already there. And Ben Shapiro, for some reason, being the liar he is, he forgot to mention the fact that many Jewish people from the late 19th century to the early 20th century started to buy land from the Palestinian people according to a systematic plan. The plan that was devised in the first Zionist conference in 1897 that was held in Geneva, right? So this plan basically put out an idea that we start taking this land from the Palestinians by hook or by crook, by means legal or illegal. Even the Ottoman Sultan at the time was approached. Sultan Abdul Hamid was approached by Theodor Herzl himself, the author of the book, The Jewish State. He approached the Sultan and he offered to pay off all his debts he owed to the Europeans in return for Palestine. The Sultan flatly refused such a proposal, saying that the land of Palestine belongs to the Muslims. I cannot simply give this land to the Zionist movement. So the partition of the land that the Zionists claimed is theirs, it wasn't theirs in the first place. The land of Palestine belonged to the Palestinians, who were predominantly Muslim. Okay, and of course, the land of Palestine belonged also to Palestinian Jews and Christians who were already living in this land. Now, these Zionists who came mostly from European countries had a very different radical idea. So they wiped out the Palestinian from these lands. Some land was bought, and then the Palestinian people caught up with the idea. They realized that this land is being stripped away systematically from them, and they resisted this takeover of the land. And then the Zionist movement conducted acts of terrorism against the British establishment and the Palestinian people to take the land of Palestine by force. This is a long history, and we can look into books like Making of the Modern Middle East to understand some of the details and the dynamics around these events. But it's not as simple as he puts it, because this land never belonged to the Zionist movement in the first place, for it to be partitioned in the way it was done later on. With regards to showing the images of the Mufti of Jerusalem meeting Hitler, we can show the images of many Jewish bankers thinkers, intellectuals meeting with Hitler. What does that prove? Does that prove that all those Jewish bankers, intellectuals, thinkers were in with Hitler to commit the Holocaust against the Jewish people? The Holocaust was a catastrophe. It was unjust. It was mass murder. It can never be justified. So showing the images of the Mufti to put out this idea as if somehow the Palestinians were involved in the Holocaust is an absolute abomination. This is an absolute lie which cannot be believed anymore. Transjordan being part of Palestine is another misstatement or misrepresentation of facts, because Jordan was always a separate country. Okay, Palestine, the land of Palestine, always constituted the borders. We know very clearly. Okay, and this land had independent rulers and governors. There were coins minted during the Abbasid period with the word Palestine inscribed on them. This was always seen as separate territory, ruled as separate territory, even during the Muslim period, going back to the Abbasid period. Even during the British Mandate period, when the British minted coins, it said Palestine on the coins. Okay? The word Palestine was inscribed on the coins from the British Mandate period. So when Arthur Balfour gave the country to Lord Rothschild in this declaration, in Balfour Declaration, when he wrote the letter to Lord Rothschild giving away the land of Palestine to the Zionist movement, or Zionist bankers for that matter, he had no right to do that. This land belonged to a people who were already there, Christians, Muslims, and some Jewish people who were there for centuries.
In 1979, Israel gave the Sinai back to Egypt in return for peace. In 1993, Israel agreed to the Oslo Accords, which promised a step-by-step process to establish a Palestinian state. In 1998, Israel conceded yet more territory to the Palestinian Authority under the prime ministership of Benjamin Netanyahu. In 2000, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak offered Yasser Arafat, the terrorist leader of the Palestinian Authority,
So Ben Shapiro is making it look like that Israel is the most charitable entity on the planet. It ceded so much territory for the sake of peace, because Israel is such a peace-loving, peace-giving, peace-providing entity that is giving away all these lands and these provisions to have peace. But the question is, why is Israel why are the Zionists there in the first place? Why are these Eastern European men and women there in the first place claiming ownership of the land, right? This is not a question of race. This is a question of legitimacy. Why are these people in this land in the first place? And what right do they have to distribute this land to whoever they like? Okay. What right do they have to have illegal settlements in the land that never belonged to them? There are United Nations charters against such actions. Israel has been facing criticism from all around the world on these actions when the land is being taken away as we speak right now by settlers. Settlers who come from the US, from Australia, from Britain, from other European countries. They are coming to Palestine and they are taking the land of the Palestinians people on gunpoint. Okay? What right do these people have to take this land, and what right do they have to give it away to anyone they like? They have no right over this land.
91% control over the West Bank in contiguous territory and an Israeli security presence along 15% of the border with Jordan. Arafat walked away from the table and began the Second Intifada, a massive terror wave that ended with the death of thousands of Jews. In 2005, Israel unilaterally withdrew from the Gaza Strip. Hamas immediately took it over and began using it as a base for terrorist activity. That continues until this day. In 2008, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert offered even more than Barak in terms of territory, with some land swaps to maintain Jewish-populated areas in exchange for some Israeli territory. Olmert even offered to relinquish Israeli sovereignty at the Temple Mount, the holiest site in Judaism, as well as the entire Old City of Jerusalem to a five-member non-sovereign international trusteeship comprising Israel, the PA, Jordan, the US, and Saudi Arabia. PA head Mahmoud Abbas walked away without a counteroffer.
Okay, again, Ben Shapiro here is making Israel or the state of Israel or the leaders of the state of Israel look like very charitable people and entities. So my question again is that If they have taken this land illegally, they have no right over this land. They have stolen the land. They have driven people out of this land. They have committed massacres of innocent people. They have imprisoned children and women and men and elderly, right? If they have done all of this, what right do they have to be charitable to the very people they have oppressed for more than 70 years? So there is no excuse one can make here for the state of Israel or the Israeli leaders. There is only one thing left for us, and that is to do justice, to declare to the world that this is the greatest injustice that has taken place anywhere in recent times, and now the world needs to speak up and do something about it. Okay?
Myth number 3. Israel expelled all Palestinian Arabs from British Mandate Palestine. This is, again, a lie. Israel's founding documents asked Arabs to stay. Israel's Declaration of Independence, in the middle of an ongoing war with Arab nations, reads, quote, "We appeal, in the very midst of the onslaught launched against us now for months, to the Arab inhabitants of the State of Israel to preserve peace and participate in the upbuilding of the state on the basis of full and equal citizenship and due representation in all its provisional and permanent institutions." Debate has raged for decades over how many Arabs left the nascent State of Israel thanks to expulsion and how many left because they were told to leave by their own leaders. An estimated 250,000 to 300,000 refugees left before their homes were even in a war zone.
We didn't compel them to leave. They left on their own will, or rather on the will of the Arab leader.
Okay. So here the claim is being made that Palestinians, they left on their own will. The Israeli soldiers or Israeli politicians or Israeli leaders didn't ask the Palestinians to leave. This is an absolute lie. This goes against all historic records from the 1940s and the 1950s. Okay, when we look at the Nakba, the great catastrophe, why is it called Nakba? Why is it called the greatest catastrophe in Palestinian psyche? Because over 1 million people were driven out of their homes. Israeli soldiers were going into Arab villages and they committed mass murder. They burnt homes. They burnt tents. Okay, and one of the ways Israelis argue that no, we haven't driven all the Arabs out of their lands is because we have Arabs in Israel today. They are citizens. But what happened to those 1 million people? Gaza, over half the population of Gaza is made of those refugees who were driven out of their homes over the last 70 years. So this is very, very clear that these people are liars. They are propagandists. They are not interested in objectivity or even accurate history. They are making up their own history as they go along. They're making up facts as they go along. And this is the greatest threat humanity has ever faced in this region. You know why? Because these people have no moral values. They have no shame. They will lie with a straight face. Okay? Anyone who picks up any basic book on the land of Palestine and on Nakba, okay, you will see over 1 million people were driven out of their homes by the Israelis, by terrorists. Okay, this person who is being shown on the screen right now, he was one of the leaders of a Zionist terrorist group that blew up British officers. And check out the famous case of King David Hotel bombing, and you will see how the Zionist movement was even killing British personnel to get their objectives met. So this is a very, very unfortunate lie that these people are putting out.
47-48 war, leaving many Arabs without a means of support, has been well documented.
Israel will do everything in its power to help the resettlement of these refugees by paying compensation and by other means.
Hundreds of thousands of these refugees ended up in the West Bank and Gaza, which remained Arab territory until 1967. Furthermore, Arab nations refused to take in hundreds of thousands of Arabs, turning their co-religionists into refugees who have maintained that status for literally decades.
So the question I would like to ask is, why was this war happening in the first place? This war was actually not a war. This was one group of people backed by the West came in with weapons to take land from poor Palestinians, most of whom were either shepherds or farmers. They were simply driven out of their villages and their homes. This was not a war. This was ethnic cleansing. This was ethnic cleansing that took place in the late 1940s when all of these Palestinians were driven out of their lands.
Hundreds of thousands of Arabs turning their co-religionists into refugees who have maintained that status for literally decades, a situation unparalleled in human history. Fully 62% of such refugees live outside the West Bank and Gaza Strip, according to the UNRWA. Meanwhile, Israel, tiny Israel, took in over 800,000 Jews expelled from Arab lands between 1948 and 1951 and never asked for land to be returned to those Jews.
Okay. So he's talking about the Jewish people expelled from Arab lands. This is actually not true. This was caused by the Zionists deliberately so that the Jewish people, their lives become unbearable, intolerable in Muslim lands because of the actions of the Zionist movement in the land of Palestine. Imagine now, the whole world is watching that a group of Jewish extremists comes to the land of Palestine with weapons, with political backing, and start wiping out Arabs and start killing them on a massive scale and start burning their villages. What do you think is going to happen to the Jewish people living throughout the Muslim territory? And even then, the Jewish people didn't want to leave Yemen. They didn't want to leave Iraq. They didn't want to leave Morocco. There is evidence, overwhelming evidence, that the Zionist movement conducted raids of terrorism against the Jewish people to drive them out of their Muslim domains into the land of Palestine to make what we know today as the land of Israel. So the Zionist movement was conducting bombing raids, okay, against the Jewish people in the Muslim territories to make the claim he just made that the Arabs were expelling the Jewish people from 1948 to 1951. This is a lie again. And the question I ask is, why didn't the Arabs expel the Jewish people for the last 1,000 years? The Jewish people were living in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, and in Morocco, in Libya, in Algeria, in Tunisia. The question is, why were the Arabs not expelling the Jewish people before 1948? What changed in 1948? If the Arabs did expel the Jewish people, what changed in 1948? This is the question the Zionists don't want to address. In 1948, these Zionists, European Zionists, they came in and they wiped out the Arabs. And as a result, the Jewish people in the Muslim territories started to feel unsafe because of the actions of the Zionist movement.
Myth number 4, Israel is an apartheid state. Israel is most certainly not an apartheid state. Arab citizens of Israel have the same rights as Jewish citizens. 20% of all citizens of Israel are Arab. The vast majority of Palestinians.
So one of the reasons he gives is that Israel is not an apartheid state because the Arab citizens of Israel have the same rights. Okay, how about the Palestinian citizens who are also, according to the Israeli propaganda, all Arab citizens, right? Why are they not treated the same way? What's happening in Gaza? Gaza is a concentration camp and has been for the last 16 years. Why is Gaza a concentration camp? Why is Gaza confined? I have been to Gaza. Myself, Adnan Rashid, I've been to Gaza. I've seen the devastation. I've seen the destruction. I've seen the restrictions and the limits that are put to people of Gaza. They cannot leave when they want. They cannot go in when they want. They cannot come out for education, for medical treatment. Their food cannot go in unless the Israelis allow it. If this is not apartheid, then what do you call apartheid? Can the Palestinians live as they want in the West Bank? Absolutely not. Their neighborhoods are confined. There are checkpoints upon checkpoints upon checkpoints. They are searched, in some cases, strip-searched by the Israeli soldiers, men and women and children. They are specifically humiliated to make them feel like slaves and occupied people. If this is not apartheid, then what is the definition of apartheid? Just because you give some rights to some citizens within the boundaries of Israel doesn't mean that you are not inflicting an apartheid on the people of Palestine.
The vast majority of Palestinians live under Palestinian rule in the West Bank. All Arabs in the Gaza Strip lived under Hamas rule. Israel's population, again, is 20% Arab. Arab parties have sat in the Israeli government. An Arab sits on Israel's Supreme Court. There are zero Jews living under Palestinian rule. The only apartheid state is any state of Palestine.
Okay. So, can the people of Gaza have the airport? Can they have their own port? Because they have sea. Gaza has sea. Can they operate their own port? Can they operate their own airport? Do they have an open independent border that they control? Certainly not. Do the people of West Bank, the Palestinian authorities of West Bank, do they have an airport? Do they have an open border? Are they allowed to operate their borders independently? Are they allowed to leave when they want? Can they go in when they want? All these things, do they exist? Absolutely they do, right? So if this is the case, then clearly the people of Gaza and people of the West Bank are the ones who are living under an apartheid. The Israelis can leave the country when they want. They can fly out wherever they want. They can fly in whenever they want. There is a program called Birthright Program, whereby children of the Jewish people from all around the world are brought to Israel free of charge to be in Israel, to enjoy the landscape and the history of Israel. Can the Palestinians do that? Can the children of Gaza come out and study the history of Jerusalem or the history of Al-Quds or the history of the Jewish temple for that matter? Absolutely not. These freedoms are not available to the Palestinian people, the freedoms the Israelis enjoy. This is what you call an apartheid.
All of these myths have consequences. All of these lies have consequences. They lead to a pseudo-sophisticated context that allows for the murder of Jews. It allows people in the West to believe that the grievances that are openly articulated by the Palestinian Authority, Islamic Jihad, and Hamas are actually about territory. Hamas openly calls for the murder of every Jew in the region. The Palestinian Authority gives
As much as we disagree with some of the groups that rule the land of Palestine, none of them call for the murder of the Jewish people. This is a lie. This is an absolute lie. This would be against their faith. Islam doesn't allow the murder of the Jewish people. The Quran doesn't allow the murder of Jewish people. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam does not allow the murder of Jewish people. How can the Palestinians call for the murder of Jewish people? This is an unbelievable lie. This is an outright lie and it's an outrage.
Gives actual bounties to the families of terrorists. Islamic Jihad has the same exact goals as Hamas. When evil people say they want to wipe Jews off the face of the earth, we ought to listen, not make up silly excuses as to why they don't actually mean what they say. The consequences of buying your own lies, not even their lies, your own lies, is dead Jews. The world has witnessed the heinous...
So this is clearly a lie that he's claiming that the Palestinians or the Palestinian leadership, they want to wipe out all Jews. This is not true. This is an absolute lie. Okay? Because if that was the case, Jewish people would never be able to live in this land at any time. But we know Jewish people lived in Palestine for hundreds of years under the Muslim rule, and why were they not wiped out then? So when the Israelis, when the Zionist government of Israel kills innocent Palestinians on daily basis, children, men, women, and elderly, right now there's a genocide taking place as we speak. There are buildings being crumbled. Actually, there are buildings being brought down on top of children and elderly who are killed in a very slow way. This is slow death. Some of these children are buried under rubble for days. They live on for days and die a slow, painful death. This is being done by the apartheid, the genocidal, the racist state of Israel under the guise of having rights over this land. And they have the audacity, people like Ben Shapiro have the audacity to claim that Israel is a democracy, Israel is a beacon of light and human rights, Israel is a beacon of justice in the Middle East. Nothing could be far from truth.
The heinous attack by Hamas terrorists against innocent Israeli citizens. This massive and devastating attack killed over 1,000 Israeli men, women, children, babies. Thousands more were injured, kidnapped, held hostage. This sworn enemy of Israel will stop at nothing to slaughter every single Jew and claim Israel as their own. But there is a beacon of hope amidst the chaos.
On October 7th, we saw what happened, and it was very unfortunate. The point is, the question is, what did the Israeli authorities do? People are questioning right now, did they kill their own citizens? Did they leave space for this to happen? Did they facilitate this to happen? All of these questions are very valid questions. And in fact, one of the people who was making this question, or he was putting up these questions, was Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk also asked these questions, that why did the state of Israel not take any action for 5 hours or 6 hours when this attack took place? So there are many, many pressing questions when all of this happened. And the point is, why would people feel so desperate to do something crazy like that? Is the first question. Why would people feel so crazy and desperate to commit an act like that? No one's asking that question. You see, the history of Palestine does not begin with October 7th. It begins in 1948 when the crime started. The crime of theft, the crime of apartheid, the crime of mass expulsion, the crime of ethnic cleansing, the crime of genocide, the crime of killing innocent men, women and children started in 1948 in the name of the creation of the State of Israel, the Zionist State of Israel. Zionism is evil. The State of Israel is evil. Something must be done to stop this injustice, to bring peace to the world.
Stephen Kappos, a name that carries the weight of history, memory, and survival. Kappos is a Holocaust survivor who has spent his life speaking out against injustice wherever he sees it. As a child, he lived through one of the darkest chapters of human history. He witnessed the brutality of fascism, the machinery of dehumanization, and the consequences of a world that looked away for far too long. Those experiences shaped him, but they did not silence him. Instead, they gave him a lifelong commitment to moral clarity, to truth, and to the belief that never again must apply to all people everywhere. In recent years, Stephen Kappos has become one of the most outspoken Jewish voices condemning the violence unfolding in Gaza and all of Palestine. His message is simple, direct, and deeply personal. What is happening today does not represent him, and it does not represent the values he believes Jewish history demands. His testimony has reached millions, especially through the viral video titled Holocaust Survivor, Absolutely Demolishes Israel, where he speaks with a moral authority that cannot be dismissed. Today, we take a closer look at that message. Kappos begins by challenging the idea that the State of Israel speaks for all Jewish people. He rejects the notion that Jewish identity can be used as a shield for state violence. He reminds us that the horrors he survived were not just about one people being targeted, but about what happens when humanity abandons its responsibility to protect the vulnerable. For him, the suffering of Palestinians is not a distant political issue. It is a moral crisis that echoes the same patterns of dehumanization he witnessed as a child. He speaks about Gaza with a clarity that cuts through political spin. He describes the destruction, the displacement, the starvation, and the relentless bombardment not as unfortunate byproducts of war, but as deliberate acts that demand accountability. And he refuses to let anyone use the Holocaust as justification for the oppression of another people. In his words, memory must be a warning, not a weapon. Kappos's voice matters because it disrupts the narratives that often dominate mainstream discourse. Too often, criticism of Israel is dismissed as anti-Semitism. Too often, the suffering of Palestinians is minimized or erased. Too often, the world is told that to stand with human rights is somehow to stand with Jewish people. Kappos rejects that framing entirely. He insists that solidarity with Palestinians is not a betrayal of Jewish history, but an expression of its deepest moral lessons. His testimony also exposes the power of narrative itself. When a Holocaust survivor says, "Not in my name," it forces the world to confront uncomfortable truths. It challenges the idea that history can be selectively remembered or politically weaponized. It reminds us that moral authority does not belong to governments or armies, but to those who have lived through the consequences of hatred and violence. And this is why his voice resonates so strongly today. Because as Gaza faces unimaginable devastation, as families are torn apart, as entire neighborhoods are reduced to rubble, the world is once again confronted with a choice: to look away or to speak out. Kapos chooses to speak, and he asks the rest of us to do the same. His message is not about politics. It is about humanity. It is about refusing to let suffering be normalized. It is about refusing to let any government claim moral legitimacy while inflicting mass harm. It is about remembering that the phrase never again loses all meaning if it is not universal. So today, as we reflect on Stephen Kapos's words, we also reflect on the power of testimony, the power of survivors who refuse to be silent, the power of truth spoken plainly, even when it is uncomfortable, and the power of moral courage in a world that often rewards silence. Let us listen closely. Let us listen with open hearts. And let us carry forward the responsibility that voices like Stephen Kapos place upon us. Because when a survivor speaks, the world has an obligation to hear.
شيل شيل عالجمال شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو.
I say this as a Holocaust survivor, that the genocide in Gaza is not happening in my name and in our name. The way that the Israeli government is using the memory of the Holocaust in order to justify what they are doing to the Gazans is a complete insult to the memory of the Holocaust. It's an outrage. When I saw the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations putting on a yellow star, it was stomach turning. Somebody who had to wear a yellow star, like myself and my entire family, I am insulted by that. What distinguishes the Jewish Holocaust is its industrial scale and industrial methods being applied. And what has been happening to Gaza is similar in that the scale of the bombing and the indiscriminate nature of the bombing, the complete lack of care about children and women being the majority of the victims, amounts to industrial scale of genocide. The painting of the Palestinian people as worthless, almost animal-like by the description of some of the leaders. That dehumanization enables the population of Israel to tolerate what's going on. The way that Palestinian people who were arrested were treated, having to take their clothes off and parading them, it's part of the humiliation. In the West Bank, the way the checkpoints are organized, the way that you are forced to wait for hours for no reason in order to go to school or go to work, etc. All this amounted to humiliation, similar to what we experienced. The sort of determination and consistency with which they are setting about to destroy the whole of Gaza is very similar to the kind of cruelty and determination of the fascist regimes, some of the actions of the Nazi state in dehumanizing and completely cruel large-scale killings, etc. If it is repeated, I don't see why you couldn't make the parallel. It can only be helpful in understanding what's going on to make the parallel. I don't think there should be any taboo against that. I think I particularly find painful to see the children. Because I remember after the war, you know, we played in the ruins like they do now. But particularly their losses, to suddenly lose parents and siblings and so on, you know. There was a boy in the same rescue homes where I was. He was traveling on a tram with his parents. This boy moved to the front to stand behind the tram driver because he was interested in how he was working the levers and so on. At the next stop, an Arrow Cross raiding party came on and asked for papers. And the parents were identified as Jews and arrested straight away. The son was separated at the front, and they had to make an immediate decision whether to say something to him and involve him or let him perhaps escape the net. And that's what they decided. So they were taken down from the tram and sent to Auschwitz. They never said goodbye to their son, and they perished in Auschwitz. So that was the end of the family. Now, can you imagine the psychological state of that boy who suddenly found himself on his own in this way, not saying goodbye to his parents. And I think this kind of thing, this separation and the sense of complete inability to intervene or in any way exert any kind of positive influence on events, this kind of separation and destruction of families in this manner is again something that repeats in Gaza now, I think. I heard that some families divide the children and leave some with one branch and some with the other, so that at least somebody should survive from the family. There's an echo of the same experience. What happened to the Jewish people, the gas chambers and the industrial scale of extermination, and also the sort of invisible aspects, the incredible emotional pain caused, is so horrendous taken together that it seems to me inconceivable that it should be repeated anywhere in the world. That is why we say not in our name and never again. And this is why I was so totally shocked, particularly by those who I know have gone through the same themselves, repeating it on another people. I take as an extreme example, one of my cousins, late cousin, she died some years ago, who was a young girl taken to Auschwitz from Transylvania. Because she was young and strong, she was put to work, and she worked in a warehouse sorting clothes. And one day, she was sorting her parents' clothes, meaning that they had already been taken to the gas chamber. I think it's difficult to understand the emotional experience of doing or being in that situation. Yet she came back to Israel, and first to Romania and then Israel, and she was as racist as the rest of them against the Palestinians. Now, how it's beyond understanding how you can do that, and with the background that she had. I think this is to do with the extreme propaganda and the dehumanization. Zionism was a very unfortunate and sad development for the Jewish people. It broke a much longer tradition of always being on the side of the oppressed, not the oppressor, and the charitable nature of the Judaism and the humanity that they advocate, into a kind of exceptionalism and nationalism.
Everything is the Jews, not a single piece for other people, only for us.
And in practical terms, impossible project of taking over another people's country, which led to all the troubles that followed. Also, I agree with my cousin, late cousin, a very bright guy, who said, well, if we claim that there is a people who tend to be the victims of other people's discrimination, etc., then the last thing you want to do is to collect them up into one place as a target. And I think he was right, and I think current events prove it. Zionism started to proclaim that the only safe place for Jews is in Israel, and what we are seeing today is the worst, the most dangerous place for Jews is Israel. Quite a number of my family from Romania ended up in Israel. So when I visited them, that was my first brush with Zionism, I was completely shocked how, despite their experiences during the Holocaust, they were racist, basically, against the Palestinians, and couldn't understand it. And I can't understand it to this day fully, how that could happen. But they were, and there's no denying it. And I found that atmosphere of racism was prevailing generally in Israel. And I turned strongly against that. Later on, I saw the repeated brutality of action against Palestinians, and it became more and more horrifying, and the very cruel attack on Gaza was the ultimate. And the use of the Holocaust background as a cover for all this was just unbearable. I mean, it was criminal, I felt. And this is when I became more active in trying to protest. Today's marches are having a very hopeful aspect. It is so large, so persistent, so global, that eventually the Western leadership, which are trying to deny what is actually going on, will be forced to face up to it. And I think we are not far from that. There was no parallel to that in the Jewish Holocaust experience. In fact, there was great abandonment. There were some, very few, very brave people who risked everything to be on the right side of history and to rescue as much as possible. But the majority of people were too afraid and looked the other way. I find it completely incomprehensible, really, how you can do anything but totally condemn quite clear genocide. And anybody who doesn't do that, it will be revisited on him or her to look back on, to be on the wrong side of history and seriously guilty. And that goes for the UK government, to Keir Starmer and the shadow cabinet, and some of the church leaders. The chief rabbi completely identifies with Israel and Zionism. I think it's important to stand up against this conflation that is propagated between Jewishness and Zionism. If you do not stand up and criticize it and divorce yourself from it, then it sort of besmirches all Jews, basically. And I think it's essential to show that from a point of view of the morale of the people that is being victimized in the name of the Jewish people, that this is not supported universally by Jewish people at all, but it's simply the Zionist and Israeli establishment which does it, which are not too far from fascistic attitudes. I think fascism thrives on indifference and the general public being intimidated or looking the other way out of self-preservation and comfort. And it's essential that is not practiced, that a certain degree of risk even taken, and always making a stand against injustice. The time will come when history will judge these events. If you are just indifferent, if you do not take a stand, you acquire a degree of guilt without any doubt. And it's important that when that judgment comes, you are found to be on the right side of history, that you had not been, for sake of comfort and advancement or whatever, you had not been inactive. You have to assert yourself against the evils around you. Knowing how the mass media ignores the most important events, it makes it incredibly important to have forums like Double Down News to bring a much more balanced picture to the public.
And with that, we bring this week's episode to a close. As always, stay curious, stay courageous, and keep asking the questions that unsettle power, cut through silence, and move us closer to justice. I'm Bethany Marks, your host and narrator. It has been a profound honor to share this space with you, a space where truth is spoken without hesitation, where resistance is held with reverence, and where solidarity is never conditional, and never up for negotiation. If you have reflections or questions, or if you feel called to step behind the mic as a future host, we welcome your voice. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, and your willingness to walk this difficult road with us. And to the remarkable team whose dedication keeps this platform alive: Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Mosa, Dr. Rana Awad, Professor Yara Rashid, Abby Masri, Juliet Salome Olivier, Renaud Al-Ghul, and our editor, Muhammad Al-Ghul. Your labor, your spirit, and your unwavering commitment are the heartbeat of this show. Each week, you remind us that storytelling is more than a craft. It is an inheritance of struggle and devotion. It is resistance. It is care. It is collective memory. Until next time, keep walking toward truth. Keep walking toward Palestine. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, proudly broadcasting for more than 20 years from WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. If you miss this radio hour, you can find us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Listen Notes, Overcast, Castro, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore over 2 decades of archives on Radio4All.net and archive.org. Simply search for This Week in Palestine or TWIP and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory gesture. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. Until then, take care. Stay steadfast. Free Palestine.
شيل شيل عالجمال يشيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو ويل ويل عالظالمي ويلو ويلو من الله لا سهر على نجوم الليل انا لا ويلو شيل شيل عالجمال يشيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو ويل ويل عالظالمي ويلو ويلو من الله لا سهر على نجوم الليل انا داويلو شيل شيل عالجمال يشيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهليل يا ليلو ويل ويل عالظالمي ويلو ويلو من الله لا سهر على نجوم الليل انا داويلو
In the hallway dim Where the sirens cry Under falling dust And a darkened sky A doctor moves with shaking hands Trying to hear what no one understands Little girl crying, holding her knee Another boy screaming, why can't I see? A woman sobs, please don't let him go My baby's barely breathing, he's all I know Doctor, please help me Doctor, where's my son? Doctor, they just bombed another ambulance run With broken hearts and empty shelves You carry the world by yourself Doctor, in the chaos, in the smoke and flame You still whisper every broken name Doctor, doctor, please help my son Doctor, where's my mom? Doctor, I can't see anything A man stands shouting, where's my girl, my wife? His hands are red, he's searching for his life But the walls are falling and the lights went black Still the doctor stays, never turning back Just a few nurses and bleeding hope No power, no tools, no way to cope But they press on with every breath Fighting for life, standing against death Doctor, please help me Doctor, where's my mom? Doctor, can you hear it? The world stay calm While we scream beneath the storm While you stitch pain all alone Doctor, with your eyes so, so tired True, this war keeps breaking you in two Doctor, doctor, please help my son Doctor, where's my mom? Doctor, I can't see anything Sorry. is gone. He whispers soft, then moves along. I'm sorry, little boy, you were left all alone. No child should bleed like this unknown. But still he tries, though his tears won't show. Though he's haunted by the faces he'll never know. I'm sorry, little boy, you were left all alone. I'm sorry the world betrayed you. I'm sorry, little boy, I'm sorry. So sorry we are all alone. Doctor, please help me. Doctor, can you rest? No medals, no cameras, but you give your best. In a world that's lost its soul, still fighting to make it whole. Doctor in Gaza, your hands may shake, but your heart is more than this world can take. Doctor, doctor, please help my son. Doctor, where's my mom? Doctor, I can't see anything. And when silence falls at the end of the night, you light one more candle, you hold one more life. Doctor in Gaza, the world may not see, but you're the heartbeat of humanity.